Welcome to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People. This show can be heard on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network every Friday at 1 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to dreamvision7radio.com, click Listen Live, and enjoy the show.
Hello, this is Dr. Emmett Miller. Welcome back to Conversations with Extraordinary People. Here, our goal is to look beyond the superficial, to encounter the essence of the human experience, to explore new and creative ways of meeting life's challenges, obstacles, and opportunities successfully, and to discover new and powerful ways of healing, balancing, and optimizing the function of mind, body, emotion, behavior, and spirit. And at this particular time in history, we do indeed desperately need to heal and transform at both the individual and the collective level. In each episode, we bring you intelligent conversations with the movers and shapers who have created the new medicine and other holistic approaches to individual and collective healing. Along with this, you will receive practical tools and experiential guided imagery meditations to help integrate the wisdom our guest brings us. So, once again, it's time to relax. Focus your mind and open your heart to the power within. And welcome to another paradigm-shattering conversation. Today's guest is Dr. Roger Morrison. Dr. Morrison was born on February 21st, 1954, at 10:21 a.m. in Rochester, New York.
I'm impressed you know that.
Okay. He grew up in Tennessee, attended medical school there, and then graduating in 1978, he worked as an emergency room physician for several years. And then during that time, he began to become, I guess it was then that you became interested in homeopathic medicine.
Even while I was in medical school, wow. I started to get interested in homeopathy.
Well, welcome to Conversations with Extraordinary People.
Thank you, Emma.
What was it that, let me back up for a second, because I think there are many people who don't know what homeopathic medicine is. What's the elevator speech, the introduction?
Well, homeopathy is one of the earliest forms of alternative medicine. It was came into being around the time when George Washington was president. So it's been practiced in Western culture for over 200 years. And the basic principle of homeopathy, well, homeopathy actually means like cures like. So just to put it in the most simple terms, if you have a runny nose from a cold or an allergy, you go to a regular doctor, they'll give you something that will make the nose dry up. If you go to a homeopath, they give something that makes the nose run more, so that provokes a defense response on the body's part, and so the body cures itself of whatever was that was wrong. So like cures like.
Very interesting. So what was it that drew you towards this? Because, I mean, there's something counterintuitive about it that, you know, if you have a stomach ache, you'll give something that actually produces a stomach ache.
Yes. I first heard about homeopathy. I was studying Buddhism, actually, it was one of my minors in college, and somebody handed me a journal, a Buddhist journal that had in it also an interview with an American doctor who was practicing homeopathy and who had been to study with the world's greatest homeopath, George Vithoulkas, in Greece. And I read the article, and I thought, what a bunch of hooey, and I tossed the thing away, and somewhere in the middle of the night, for reasons I'm not sure, I woke up and thought, what if that was true? And I went and retrieved the article out of the trash can And then I started to do a little bit of research into homeopathy. And sometime shortly after that, I was a medical student and I was working in the emergency room. And a patient had come in with multiple sclerosis many times into this emergency room and came in one time looking fantastic. And I said, "What happened? What did you do?" And she said, "I went for homeopathy." And of course, I had already started to do a little research on it. And between those two things, I thought, well, let me explore a little further. And I wrote to George Fotholkis in Greece and got invited to come to a seminar there while I was still in medical school. And showed up in Greece a few days early so I could do some touring around, and went into the center in Greece and sat down hoping to meet Dr. Fotholkis. And it was a very crowded waiting room, probably 15 by 15 feet and 20 people waiting for different homeopaths to come and get them. And the woman next to me started to speak in Greek, and of course, at that time, I didn't speak any Greek, and she found out that I was an American doctor, which is a big deal in Greece, and she started to explain to me that she'd had horrible migraine headaches and that she'd come to this clinic and she'd been cured. And while she was talking, the woman next to her sort of said, "Who's this?" and said, "Oh, tell the doctor my story." And then she was telling me about her horrible arthritis that she'd had through this interpreter. Mm-hmm. And within 10 minutes, the entire waiting room was standing in a semicircle around me, you know, saying essentially, "Tell the doctor my story and my story." Mm-hmm. And they had been cured of lupus and, you know, autoimmune conditions and psychiatric problems. And I never did get to see Dr. Fotholkis or any homeopath that day. But I was so impressed by the number of people and the depth of the complaints that they were being cured of, not just that they were being treated for, because many of these people had simply stopped their medication. They were just in for follow-up visits, not taking anything, and completely cured of conditions that I knew darn well you can't cure people from. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got interested in homeopathy.
Right, that could kind of wake you up a little bit. Huh?
It made a big difference because wow. I was not happy with regular medicine, you know, my training, and it didn't feel like it really fit for me. It was a lot of very mechanical, I won't say inhumane because it was done with good treatments, but the connection uh-huh. between the patient and the physicians in my training program mm-hmm. was not very good. People were not treated as humans. They were treated as walking conditions that had to be fixed and were put on medications. And if the medications didn't help or had terrible side effects, that was just part of the game plan. So I was pretty discouraged with medicine. And when I found this type of medicine, mm-hmm. you know, there was no looking back after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah, there was that feeling in medicine as though a patient is just a sort of vector whose purpose is to bring a disease to the physician. And the physician interacts with the disease and sends the patient away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Without ever knowing. I had an experience with a friend, and she and I were close at the time, and we were playing around, and by mistake, I moved in a certain way, and she reflexively reached up to block my movement and twisted her wrist and hurt her wrist. And then a couple of days later, and she was in nursing school, and she had a sore throat. So she went to the doctor, and the doctor asked her all of these questions and said, "Well, you know, based on 1, 2, and 3, you have rheumatic fever." And he put her in bed for 4 months. She had to stop school and everything. And I went, you know, how did you come to that conclusion? One of the main points was that she had joint pain, because you have joint pain with rheumatic fever.
Oh.
But it's usually in multiple joints and it moves around, but it was joint pain. And so he got to kind of tick that one off. She had a sore throat, yeah. Got to tick that off and a couple of other things. And I said, this is amazing. This is the way you make a diagnosis in medicine. And that was really one of the things that started really attracting me to look at medicine. So, oh, because I've always had this, my goal throughout all of my life has been to study transformational change.
Hmm.
I like the concept of transformation. In mathematics, I love point-set topology. How do you transform one space into another space? And indeed, the healing process is a transformational process, not simply that iterative process that Western medicine would make it look like. So that's really one of the things that drew me into medicine. And I see it drew you in, it drew you in a little bit. You were already in medicine, but you kind of bent your arc at that point.
Absolutely.
And then you went and learned Greek so you could study with this child.
Yes, I wanted to go back to study with George Vithoulkas, and he had a very large center. It was 30 full-time medical doctors, a patient population of over 100,000 at that time.
Whoa.
And we were seeing about 50 to 60 new patients per day.
Wow.
At the clinic. And they were from all walks of life in Greece. And you can imagine that mm-hmm. an operation like this that was having tremendous results was making an enormous impact on a small country like Greece.
Yeah. Yeah, really.
And so I knew I had to go and study with him. There was very little training available, almost none available in the United States at that time.
And what year was that?
That was 1979, 1980. Uh-huh. Then it took me a while in order to get permission to go and work in Greece, and I had to take medical boards and so forth in Greek. So it was a big process to get to go and work there. So it took me a few years. So I didn't get to Greece until 1982. Working with Vithoulkas, I was basically living in his shed for the 2 years that I was there. And pretty much our routine, we'd wake up around 5 in the morning and start to study all the new cases, because he personally chose the remedy on every new case, or helped in the decision on every new case every day in this clinic that was working 6 days a week with a huge number of. So he had to start early in the morning to go through that. And we'd work on these cases. You know, I would just sort of do rough analysis and he would make the final decision. So it was a great learning experience. And then he would go in and see his own patients probably around 6 in the evening until 10. And we'd have dinner and then start up the next morning again. And then in the middle of the night, often he'd come knock on the shed door and say, we've got to go to the hospital. And off we'd go to a hospital somewhere to see somebody that was critically ill. And so it was a fantastic learning experience. And
almost like a traditional apprenticeship.
It was an apprenticeship.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a fantastic thing. And he was a mentor on many levels, because he's a deeply spiritual man and he's very involved in meditation and other practices, as well as homeopathy, and he saw them fitting together. He felt that it was necessary to have a spiritual path in order to be a good homeopath, because we're looking at people on as deep a level as we can. So it's a lot of it has to do with their psychology, their spiritual areas where they're spiritually blocked. All of that goes into the diagnosis in homeopathy. So it was necessary to have a person of that kind of depth to mentor under for those years. So it was, I was very blessed to have that opportunity.
Oh, you were really in the eye of the hurricane there.
I was.
Wow. So, and this is and as you talk about the spiritual and psychological aspects of it, it would make one think that there's something different about homeopathy other than just going to that shelf at Whole Foods that lists homeopathic memories and remedies and picking the drops that'll help cure your wart.
Well, like everything, every form of medicine can be practiced at different levels. You know, you can do it superficially, like just, you know, take the remedy for warts that's at health, you know, at the health food store. Or you can try and go more and more deeply into the life force to try and find the way to open that life force up so it can really blossom in the proper way. So homeopathy can be practiced at any level, from the most superficial to the deepest, and it's effective on every one of these levels, and everybody sort of finds the level that they're most comfortable working with.
And homeopathy incorporates the principle of the life force?
It does. You know, homeopathy teaches that, in fact, the term that Hahnemann coined going back over 200 years was the vital force. He felt that all disease came from a disturbance in the vital force of the individual, mm-hmm. which includes psychological problems as well as physical problems. And he felt that if you could find a way to attune or to strengthen that life force, that all of the different problems that you have can get better from just one treatment, as long as you're working with the central vitality and strengthening that will help on any level. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so very frequently we have people that come in only for psychiatric conditions to homeopathy. Mm-hmm. And many times, of course, people come in just needing help with their joint troubles or their headaches. Mm-hmm. So it's...
And does homeopathy go into what does this life force consist of? Or,
you know, Hahnemann was very specific about that. He said, we can't know what the vital force really is, and we shouldn't spend a lot of time theorizing about anything. Homeopathy is a very empirical study. So the less theorizing, the better, according to Hahnemann. Mm-hmm. And so he didn't spend any time trying to analyze what the vital force was, only analyzed how he could work with it to make it stronger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, one could see how that could be on a collision course with allopathic medicine.
Yes, he was hounded out of town after town as he was developing his theories, but ended up a wealthy man, dying in his late 80s, married to a 34-year-old French woman who was also a great homeopath. So he ended up all right, but he had a tough time of it in his early years, for sure. Now we look back on what Hahnemann said and just really kind of with awe, because he made so many bold predictions about health and how homeopathy would work that turned out to come true. How he came to his ideas is he was an amazing genius. He was fluent in 17 languages and knew all of the medical research, and had kind of like a lot of us that ended up in homeopathy, he gave up practicing medicine at a certain point in his early 20s because he felt he was doing his patients more harm than good. One of Hahnemann's original contributions was he was the first person that spoke out very strongly against leeching and bleeding as a means of medical treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very aware of the fact that our first president, George Washington, was essentially bled to death by his physicians.
Mm.
He didn't die of his medical condition. He died of being exsanguinated. So Hahnemann was one of the first people that spoke out strongly against that. And he knew what he didn't like in medicine, but he couldn't figure out what was the proper way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And he was working as a translator instead of a physician, and he came across a work on China officinalis, which is Peruvian bark, China, which is quinine, and its treatment, its first treatment for malarial conditions. And he read in the book that China or quinine works because it's so bitter it drives out the evil humors of malaria. And he scratched his head and said, that is ridiculous. That can't possibly be the explanation. So he started to take very small doses of quinine himself just to see what the effects of the quinine were. And he recorded this in amazing detail. And what he found was that the symptoms he developed while he was taking the quinine were identical to the symptoms of malaria, right down to fevers and chills and sweats that came back recurrently and the body aches and the headaches and so forth. And so he began to hypothesize that the reason that quinine worked to cure malaria was because it created malaria-type symptoms. And then he began testing all the known medicines in the world at that time, and he developed a set of symptomatology for each of the known mercury and arsenic, which were used as medications, as well as all the herbs that were used. And he developed a database for what are the symptoms, not just the main symptoms, but all the small symptoms, including what dreams did people get, what foods did they crave, what were their sleep patterns. And he wrote these down in excruciating detail. And then after he had enough of these medicines, he started to practice by listening to people's symptoms. And then when he could match the whole gamut of symptoms that the person had to one of the medicines that he had done these tests on, then he found great curative benefit from this. And that's how he coined the term homeopathy. And that's more or less what we do today, except we have a lot more of these homeopathic medicines. Hahnemann practiced with about 100. We have about 4,000 now. So
wow. So after your fellowship, you came back and started an institution here, right?
Yes, because there was almost no training in homeopathy at that time. So we decided that we would start a large clinic. So we had started out with about 12 homeopathic practitioners together. And then we began teaching medical doctors and nurses and other trained professionals to do homeopathy. We taught eventually it was a four-year course, and we took people through this four-year course, and at the end of that, they were well enough trained that they could go out and practice homeopathy on their own. So we did that for 20-some years, and then we left the work of training to our students, and now we just practice homeopathy.
All right. Well, we'll come back in a moment, and I'm going to want to ask you a little bit about just how you go about practicing it, and what is it that people should know? What kinds of issues should send them to a homeopath, and what might they expect? Meanwhile, I want to remind everyone that you're listening to Conversations with Extraordinary People, which is a publicly supported program. That is, we stay on the air as long as we receive support from you. The way you can support us is by visiting our multimedia website, drmiller.com, where you can learn more. You'll find my videos, archives of these conversations, such as the one you're listening to now, and a plethora of information on mind-body medicine, self-healing, guided imagery, and software for the mind. You'll also find my free newsletter and the regular free guided imagery and meditation gifts. And then if you click on store, and that will take you over to our online store at shopdrmiller.com, where you will find the audio and video programs that feature these self-applied deep relaxation and guided imagery meditations for healing body, balancing and invigorating the emotions, overcoming bad habits, and achieving peak performance. The idea is that you can really create an upgrade to your own operating system, how you operate your mind and how it interfaces with your body, your emotions, and the world around you.
You can also support us by telling your friends and clients, patients, and those on your mailing list about what we offer. And join in the conversation on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AskDrMiller. That's Ask Dr. Miller. You can learn more about today's guest by visiting our website.
Yes.
Which is?
HerrickMorrison.com. My wife, Nancy Herrick, and Morrison.com.
HerrickMorrison.com. Excellent. And so, of course, we're here with Dr. Roger Morrison, one of the co-founders of the Hahnemann Clinic. And you've been, and it's someone who's worked in this field for a very long time. And found it to be a successful way of working with people who are suffering from this, that, or the other. What can a person expect when they go to a homeopath, and who should go?
Well, almost any condition can be affected by homeopathic treatment. The ones that have the least effect are when there's structural problems, because homeopathy works on the overall defense mechanism in the body, but it can't change things that are structurally wrong. So if you have a surgical condition, you have a broken leg, homeopathy may help with the healing, but you still have to have the bone set. Or if you have a heart valve that needs to be redone, homeopathy will have very limited benefit for something that's structurally abnormal like that.
So you might get a screw in the bone or get a cast put on it or something like that. But you say homeopathy can help with the healing.
Sure.
Well, isn't that all you do? Put a cast around it and it gets better?
Well, sometimes, and a lot of times that's all that's needed, and then you would never end up in the hands of a homeopath. So most people end up with us really because they flunked the standard medical model. They've gone in, they've tried to get treatment. It had whatever effect it had, maybe not enough. And so the person starts looking for something, you know, that they could do beyond what their regular doctor is offering. So that's how most people end up with us. And conditions, I mean, homeopathy is excellent for autoimmune conditions. It's, you know, fantastic for allergies, asthma, migraines. It's great for various emotional problems. It's great for many forms of arthritis, although, like I say, if a joint has to be replaced, that's beyond what homeopathy is going to help with. So it's great with children because it's so safe. We love treating children because with homeopathy, there's virtually no side effects from the treatment. So it either helps you or it doesn't do anything. So that's a great advantage with kids. So yeah, there's very few conditions that homeopathy can't be beneficial for. Of course, nothing works for everybody, but generally speaking, well-trained homeopath gets great results with a very wide variety of conditions.
And what sort of tools or techniques do you work with?
Well, homeopathy is always the same technique. So I was explaining how Hahnemann did the testing on, you know, the early medicines, but since then homeopaths have tested around 4,000 different medications, mostly coming from herbs, minerals, and some from various animals, like the venom of bees and so forth are used. Even oyster shell is used as a remedy in homeopathy. So all three of the natural kingdoms are used as medicines, and then we do these extensive testings like Hahnemann taught. After doing all this extensive testing, then we made a very large database of all the symptoms as they relate to the various homeopathic medications. And this database has grown now to being slightly larger than the Encyclopedia Britannica. So we have a huge database. Computers have made our job so much easier, because before trying to do all that by hand was, you know, just with books was a huge job. So we're saving a lot of time. Thank you to Steve Jobs and company. So we have this database where almost any symptom that you can imagine, we can look up on the database and find which homeopathic remedies have cured, first caused, and then cured. In order to get into the database, it had to cause the symptom and it had to cure it in some clinical cases. So when it's done both, then it gets added into the database, and we can look up almost any symptom and find the remedies. And then if a person comes in, they have certain type of headache that's over their right eye at 9 in the morning, we can look in our database and find that particular symptom and match that with all the other symptoms that the person has, including their food cravings and sleep patterns and so forth. When we can find a remedy that matches as closely as possible, that's going to be the remedy that does the most good for the patient.
Uh-huh.
So the technique is always the same, but it has become modernized, and it's very interesting. In the past, say, 20 years, homeopaths have made certain discoveries. So before, it was kind of a dry thing of just find the exact symptoms that the person has, match them, and that's the remedy. What we discovered later is that there's whole systems that you could look at, so that all of the remedies made from salts of sodium have certain characteristics in common. All the plants that are of the ranunculus family have certain traits in common. And through cured cases, we've been able to identify what are the common elements for each of these families of remedies. So we've been able to look at the families, and sometimes we can choose the remedy just based on the fact that we know that this is a person that needs a ranunculus remedy, and we can eliminate all the other remedies, the other 4,000 remedies, from consideration, so we can really zero in quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But then another fascinating development was that we realized that the person, when they need a specific remedy, often is very attracted to that remedy on their own.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, I had a patient that came in with very severe migraine headaches, and these had happened after some years of having seizures, and the characteristic of her headache was that they were 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, continuous. Horrible situation, and homeopaths have a particular symptom, which is headache continued, meaning it goes on and on and on. So there are about 40 homeopathic remedies that are listed for this, and then one of those, as I scrolled through the remedies to see, one of those was a known remedy for seizures, which she had had earlier in her life. And that was the remedy indigo, made from the plant indigo. And so I said to her, trying to provoke a reaction, I said to her, well, do you have a specific color that you really are attracted to in general? And she said, well, I like purples and blues. And I said, I said, what about indigo? And she says, indigo is like the most major thing in my life. And she lifts up her journal book that she was reading me from, and on the title, she's called this book The Indigo Dream Journal. And in addition, her home, she named Indigo Acres. And so the remedy went all the way through. It's that people know intuitively, so sometimes it will come out in dreams. I had one patient with severe arthritis who, based on the characteristics of the arthritis, I thought that one of the rhododendron species would be likely to be a good choice for her. I said, do you have any hobbies? And she said, oh, yes, I love gardening. I said, what do you like about gardening? She says, the only thing I like in gardening is I grow rhododendron plants. And I've got 100 bushes. And this started happening more and more in our cases. And we realized that this information was sitting there. And for 200 years, homeopaths had gone without it because we just didn't think to ask the patient, well, what do you, what are you attracted to? What's in the depth of you? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So now as we start to explore that, we've found all sorts of ways that people will access their remedy will run through their whole life, and it will be often a very deep, one of the deepest things about them that they've never been able to explain. Why was she so attracted to indigo? It's because indigo was the remedy. She, within days of taking indigo, her migraines vanished, never to return again. And not only that the migraines went away, but she felt better in herself, and she felt her freedom in her life and lifelong depression that disappeared and so forth. So,
That's amazing.
The homeopathic remedy is something that goes to the very core of the individual when we find it correctly. And we use any clue we can to get to it, whether it's something as simple as a food cravings. Obviously, people that have that need a remedy from one of the milk sources will have craving for milk often, or strong aversion to milk, one way or the other. So the remedy can be found through something as simple as a food craving, as complex as a dream, or a recurring pattern in their interests and their passions in life. The remedy will make itself known to the homeopath by one means or another. And when we can find that remedy, then we can see tremendous results. When and we're just guessing around the corners, then, of course, then we don't get as good results. So the clearer the remedy is and for the person, the more likely they are to get, you know, the really dramatic results that homeopathy can sometimes.
Would the homeopath ask the question, why would indigo be attractive to this woman, as if there's some knowledge someplace or whatever was making this lady attracted to growing ranunculus?
Right.
What does that? What is that?
We don't know, but the way homeopaths speak of it now is that there's two songs going on in the system. And that's what creates the problem. So there's their normal human song that they were born with, and then there's something that comes and becomes superimposed on them. Something for a particular reason, a particular causation, that they need something to do with indigo at that time, or they feel something that only indigo expresses in human consciousness. Maybe it's in this case, it was a very profound feeling of depression that the color indigo just represented to this particular person. For another person, it won't be the color indigo. It'll be something completely different, so that they will need a different remedy, obviously. So so people relate to or seem to become affected by a particular energy pattern that is indigo in one case, or rhododendron in another, or ranunculus in a third. So that particular energy pattern that they need to help them then becomes superimposed on their system. So they need it at a particular time. After that, it's just creating havoc in their system, and then they need the homeopathic dose to cure them from that particular pattern of energy.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, it seems like there's two groups of people who might be particularly interested in homeopathy: those for whom the usual allopathic techniques haven't worked, or where there's delayed healing, where one would have expected things to get better quickly, and certainly those people who are really curious to find out. And so maybe I have minor symptoms, or maybe even I have symptoms that can be taken care of allopathically, but hey, you know, what if there's something within me that can heal this, that can bring me back to balance without my having to put any foreign substances in my body?
Yeah.
You know, and there's a whole philosophical aspect of it. And so just in terms of knowing oneself better, it might be really interesting to hear what homeopathy has to say about it.
Well, many times patients tell me, you know, because the homeopathic interview usually takes at least 2 hours to go through. So people tell me at the end of it, doctors have never asked me these questions before. And in fact, nobody has ever learned as much about me as you have in this during the course of this interview. And it's not because I'm a better person or a better doctor. It's just that's the technique of homeopathy. Mm-hmm. We need to know everything in order to make the most accurate diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting. Well, now, and as we're talking, I'm thinking of in chiropractors often have a phenomenon, they call it the innate, that there is an innate wisdom that is within a person. And they feel that by doing certain maneuvers with the body, they're communicating with that innate wisdom, and among other things, freeing nerve channels so that that wisdom that is at our, wherever it is within us, can travel out through the nervous system and reach the organs that may be affected. And I think back to Claude Bernard and his struggle with the system at the same time as Louis Pasteur. And Louis Pasteur believed that diseases were caused by or being invaded by bad guys from the outside. And Claude Bernard said, yeah, that's true sometimes, but a lot of the time it's what he called host factors, that there's a homeostasis, a vital balance that should be maintained within, and anything that upsets that balance can cause a breakdown in our defenses. And yes, we may get a strep throat, but that may be because the host defenses have broken down. One of the things I discovered in my work, when I would see people with a strep throat, and I would ask them questions about their lives, and probably three-fourths of the time, they were having some stress in their lives having to do with speaking. They had an oral exam coming up. They'd been lying to their wife. There's something that they needed to say to their boss. You know, whatever it was, this person had an emotional tension around this. And of course, that emotional tension, and what I talked about is, you mentioned a song, and I've called it music, or like a symphony that's playing, that organizes all the organs and all the cells of the body and gets them all to work together in balance within themselves and with each other. And when that song is interrupted or confused in some way, then the signals going to a certain organ system or part of the body may be disrupted, and that can give rise to the illness. In the case of the throat, one of the functions of the lining of the respiratory tree, of course, is the ability to produce interferon, which stops viruses from spreading. So you have tension around this part of your body, around your voice. You know, if we record your voice and you talk about something and you're tense about it, and you can use this as a lie detector, you can see there are these oscillations that are superimposed upon the smooth frequency of the voice. And you can tell when a person has stress about something. So continued stress about the voice, limiting the production of interferon, viruses get lodged in there, and streptococcus can come in and take over. So very similar kind of process.
Yes, homeopathy believes just exactly that.
Isn't that amazing?
It's many, many different directions to the same conclusion.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and Hahnemann concluded this 200 years ago
and gave
us one technique for dealing with it.
Uh-huh. That's amazing. And of course, Claude Bernard lost out to Pasteur, and he was pushed into the background. And yet it's said that on his deathbed, that Pasteur said, in the final analysis, Claude Bernard was probably correct.
I mean, we can't discount the infections from the outside and all the good that's been done by antibiotics and But we know that many times that that's not, you know, when your kid keeps getting ear infections, there's something else wrong. It's not just that there's a bacteria there. And that's what we have to, in order to not wreck the kid's system by just dosing them over and over again with the antibiotics, we have to find out the deeper cause. And then when we correct that, then we don't have to give the antibiotics. And even modern medicine is going in this direction. They don't want to overuse antibiotics. They want to save it for when it's really necessary.
Yeah, because we've sort of messed up the biome out there.
Yeah.
By what we've done now, we've selected out the most vicious organisms, and those are the one you, worst place you can be is in the hospital.
Right.
Because the germs there have learned to beat all the antibiotics. Right. That's really the A team of pathogens.
Well, I think it's forcing modern medicine to look at things, try to look at things from a different standpoint, and I think that's good for people that practice alternative approaches like you and I.
So. Yeah. Has allopathic medicine yet found a way to include the concepts of homeopathy and... Because I understand there was a struggle early last century.
Oh, there was. In fact, if you look at the original charters of the AMA, it was formed specifically to compete with homeopaths.
To compete.
Yeah, to block the growth of homeopathy. So, in many places in the world, South America, homeopathy is a very prominent part of the standard system. In
England?
In India. England, it's not as much now. Yeah. There's been a lot of repression of homeopathy in the past decade.
Wow.
In England, but in Germany and France, homeopathy is integrated very well into the medical model. And, I think that as more and more double-blind studies have been done with homeopathy, and I think as more information becomes available, eventually it will become readily accepted by the medical system and integrated the way it is in some of these other countries.
It's really fascinating that people operating under that old paradigm of me versus you and us and them and good or bad and black or white, that way of thinking makes you think that your religion has to be the religion and your approach to medicine or whatever it is has to be yours and anyone else is wrong.
Right.
And the whole notion of the both and of integrating things together is so opposite to the way so many people have been trained to think. And I think is at the basis of a huge amount of disease individually and certainly institutionally and culturally is, there's a part of the human being that can be very prejudiced, and that prejudice can stop you from seeing the truth, even if the truth is killing you and the people around you.
Right.
Once you drink the Kool-Aid.
Yeah, it's all fear, it seems to me.
It's fear-based.
Yeah.
Right. And the other is, and where I think spirituality comes in, is you don't have to operate from fear, that there's enough for everybody. Right. That wherever all of this comes from or whoever all of this comes from, that wisdom, that knowledge knows how we can all live together.
Right.
And if we start looking for how can I use the best of what you have and you can use the best of what I have and we can make something that's more than either of us have. It's like the blind man carrying the lame man.
Right.
And that... that's where we need to go.
Yeah.
Because.
And the sooner the better.
Yeah. Well, it's been really wonderful having you with us here today, although we've had a few struggles, which fortunately our listeners have not had to deal with, but we have. So I really appreciate your patience. It's clear to me that simply from having an experience of coming to you and listening to you and interacting with you because of the demeanor and the heartfulness that you bring to what you do is going to be healing to people. And if
we have to heal in every way that we can.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
With our being, with our practice, with our remedies, with our everything should be healing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's definitely a spiritual activity as well as something that's physical. And I'd like to remind folks out there that when we're talking about healing, we're talking about wholeness. And there's wholeness at the physical level. You know what that is. You stop bleeding or you stop hurting. There's wholeness at the emotional level, at which there's a balance among your emotions and you're passionately engaged in living your life, and you experience deep and meaningful love relationships. There's a wholeness in terms of the mind and your intellect, and that is when you're able to focus on what needs to be focused on, when it needs to be focused on, and whether or not you feel like doing it at the moment, you do it because you've decided you're directing your attention and your intention in that way. And mental wholeness means being able, therefore, to focus, to commit, and to withstand what we need to withstand while thinking effectively. That's mental wholeness. Creativity is another measure, an even higher measure of the mental wholeness. So to heal is to become more whole. And of course, that would go for relationships as well. Becoming more whole in your relationship, restoring love and respect and kindness and generosity and a sense of deep connectedness. That's wholeness in terms of a relationship. And to comment on that, the little story of the indigo and how a person's love for the color indigo or for the ranunculus could be a clue in some way about what would bring healing into their lives. That is, a restoration of balance and a more deep discovery of oneself. It sort of reminded me of a principle I learned from a Lakota Sioux medicine man, Buck Ghost Horse. And he said they believed that if someone in the teepee got sick, if you walked around the outside, you'd find there'd always be a plant growing nearby that you could make a tea out of that would treat whatever illness that person had. And often it would be a plant that people had never noticed growing around the home before. So it's similar in a way. In other words, there's an unconscious part of ourselves, and maybe, as Jung suggests, that unconscious, our personal unconscious, merges with the universal unconscious. And that's a bit of a stretch, although some of us can go there. But simply on the basis of our individual minds, my individual mind has a conscious part of myself that can act intentionally. And then there's this vast part of me that I cannot be directly conscious of. But there's a huge amount of information stored within it, a huge amount that's been learned during my lifetime, and maybe even a huger amount that I inherited. And he talked about that song inside. I've always thought of it then as a song or a melody that plays from within inside, or maybe a symphony, that all the organs of the body dance in time with. It's like watching a beautifully choreographed three-ring circus or Cirque du Soleil, when there's intricate movements of all of these parts that interplay with each other, that mesh so well. That's health in the body. This balance of the organs within the body, within each organ and between and among the organs. And that there's always this music that's playing from within us. And when we can be in tune with that and in tune with our environment, there's a kind of resonance that happens that leads us to success, because it's all about the balance that we create with the world around us. And if we can hear that tune within us, if we can feel it, if we can get rid of anything that blocks it. And so by doing deep relaxation and imagery, what I'll be doing is helping people remove the blocks to that energy flowing through their body by dealing with those mental structures, the memories, the expectations, fears, and beliefs, and so forth. We can find those areas of conflict, and by relieving that conflict, by bringing in relaxation and peace, as that conflict dies away, then the information from that innate intelligence can be heard, that music can flow through the system. It's like your mind's not chattering away, distracting you, so you can hear the thoughts that it's important to hear. You're not stuck in any emotions, so you can really respond empathetically and compassionately and passionately with the world around you. And it then has its reflection on the body itself. And so then we begin to see the healing at the physical level. And you might even say that you're waking up in the middle of the night knowing that you needed to study this specialty of homeopathy. Maybe that was part of that same inner music, just awakening you like a clock radio in the middle of the night. So thank you so much for being with
My
us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And people can learn more about your work by going to HerrickMorrison.com, HerrickMorrison.com. And for the folks out there who would like to discover more about my work, again, I'd invite you to drmiller.com, where you can always hear this broadcast as well as all the other shows we've done here on Conversations with Extraordinary People. So go to drmiller.com, and if you'd like to listen to some samples of the materials I've put together and see this huge raft of DVDs and CDs and downloads to deal with all kinds of issues, go to drmiller.com and click on the word store at the top of the page. And if you have any questions or comments or contributions you'd like to share with us, please do so and join our ongoing conversation at facebook.com/AskDrMiller. That's Ask Dr. Miller. So, again, until we meet again, stay tuned.
You've been listening to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People, on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For more information about Dr. Miller's work, upcoming events, new programs, and how you can change your mind and change your life, visit his multimedia website at drmiller.com. That's drmiller.com. Conversations with Extraordinary People is produced in the drmiller.com studios. Special thanks to Jesse Churchill and Deborah Beauvais.